Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. Open loops. You must listen to the open loops, a theme park for absurd beliefs and systems of integration between the mind and the creative spirit. Open loops.
So much content to choose from. Netflix, Disney Plus, Hulu, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts, Clubhouse, Instagram Stories. So much content, so much to consume, so much for your conscious mind to have to focus on now. And while you're doing that, I'm speaking to you, your unconscious mind can now tune in to your favorite late night talk show for the Shamelessly Fringe. It's Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, conversations that bend. Hey, everybody. Hello, Greg Bornstein here. It is Open Loops with Greg Bornstein, conversations that bend. Today's the beginning of a special series we're calling Podcast Pegasus, the Time Travel Disclosure. Dialogues? I should call it dialogues. I think I went with series because I did the deep dive hypnosis without trance dialogues, trying to spice it up. Doesn't really matter what you title it. It's what it represents. It's all about what it represents on this show. Even the name Open Loops is a tribute to that, which, well, I'll explain what that means in a second. For those that don't know about me, my name is Greg Bornstein. I am a cultural hypnotist, a curator of experience, and a consciousness disruptor. Yes, my goal is to break and wake people out of the everyday societal cultural trances that they're in currently and bring them to new ones. How? Very simply, actually, by challenging your existing belief systems with radically unique ideas shared by me and featured guests. These ideas are designed to stimulate your unconscious mind and force you to step into the highest version of yourself. Open loops are just those things that make us do that because they're unconscious provocations. They're what happen when you start something, like I said at the beginning, what's an open loop, and you don't finish the statement. A cliffhanger, a dot dot dot. It's the space between not knowing and knowing, and the infinite possibilities within that space. Interestingly enough, this is a show that explores topics that lead to tons of open loops because they're infinite possibilities. The topics that take us away from it all. Magic, hypnosis, spirituality, conspiracy, the fringe, the paranormal. And really, the most important topics of them all. Who and what we really are. Today's episode, as I mentioned, I've been building up to this one for a while. And what's great about a time travel episode is that there will be references to interviews that I've already released, perhaps even references to interviews I haven't released, but isn't that what time travel's about? Perhaps this episode already came out at some point, and you are now catching up, or I've always been in your future, you're hearing this in the past. There are all kinds of mysteries around time travel. That said, what if there was a grounded, scholarly, perhaps deeply, deeply intelligent, reasonable voice that sat you down and said, hey, time travel's real. I experienced it firsthand. I've met President Lincoln. I've met George Washington. I've really done this. And also, I'm proud to talk to the entire world about it and don't even fear the consequences of being labeled a quack or... Nope, I'm going out there and I'm spreading the truth. Andrew D. Bashago is perhaps one of the most grounded guests I've ever had, and he is exactly that. There is no way you're going to listen to this episode and walk away going, well, I mean, okay, you know, Greg has some weird guests on, so this is just another weirdo. I defy you to come on my show after listening to this and tell me why this guy's making this thing up. He is the closest thing that I might be there. I might believe him. I mean, look, it's hard for me epistemologically. Oh gosh, he says it a lot in the show. It's early in the morning. It's hard for me philosophically in general, as someone that is not an experiencer, which you're going to learn a lot about that in the later episode of this, to be able to go, okay, well, he says it's true. It sounds great. I fully believe him. I believe in life. The truth comes from firsthand experience. However, the more I spend time with Andrew, the experience of truth and rational thinking and that desire, that existential desire at Andy's core to really understand what happened to him makes me as close as I'm ever going to get to hearing something that sounds paranormal and buying into it. I have told you in the past, I've told guests repeatedly that I am paranormal agnostic, conspiracy agnostic. Hypnosis is real. I'll tell you that's true. Not fully sure. I come from a more, okay, but why is this the case? Perspective. Really, really, and I throw Andy some hardballs in this interview. However, I was looking for a time traveler. I wanted a real life time traveler. And consistently, this man is the guy. I had several conversations before we did this interview, and they were, I wish I'd recorded them. And then we did this interview, which is only the beginning of Andrew D. Bashago and the Open Loops connection. And I wanted to release it in multiple parts. There's going to be one coming out every day this week to really delve into what Project Pegasus was. Because if you are telling me that there was actually 8 different forms of time travel that the U.S. government had patented that kids were experiencing in late 50s, early 60s, 70s to be responsible for influencing events, and we had this technology and you could teleport and all this stuff, imagine what they have now. There's going to be a surprise at the end of this week that delves a little more into that. However, Andrew D. Bashago, I'm giving you so much of the prelude, but this episode, this series of episodes is why I started this podcast. I am so, so honored that a former presidential candidate Andrew Dubashago was on this show. Time traveler, the guy, the chrononaut. That's a word that was created to, I believe it comes from fiction, but yeah, it's a traveler of time instead of space. Andrew Dubashago is perhaps the closest you're ever going to listen to someone who has actually really done this. In a time when alien disclosure is imminent, supposedly, why not make time travel disclosure also part of that? Let's get it all out there. Part one delves into the beginning of the project, the beginnings of Andy and the project, a little bit about Project Galileo, which sounds interesting in and of itself, which was the education, the rapid learning program Andy had to be going through back then in order to know pretty much all of history before he traveled. This multi-part series, I'm so proud of, and I'm so happy for you to listen to it. I want more of the world to know that this guy is out there. Please make sure that if you like conversations like this with whistleblowers of hyper advanced technology coming forward and saying, yes, this really happened, if you're into that kind of thing, make sure you share Open Loops with Greg Bornstein to friends, family, and travelers from the future. Because I'm not sure what kind of content they get up there, but if it's Ginny and Georgia season 3, and that's what they're watching in the future, I mean, at the very least, you could throw this into the ring, kind of spice things up a little bit. And also, of course, if you enjoy Open Loops, please make sure to follow it on your preferred podcast platform. And if it's Apple Podcasts, if you could please rate the show and leave a couple words to review it, that really helps. I'm very grateful for that. Grateful for you listening. Grateful for Andrew to help make Podcast Pegasus the time travel disclosure series even possible. Yes, Back to the Future is my favorite movie of all time. Andrew Dubashago is the closest thing to the real-life Marty McFly. Enjoy part one. Well, everybody, big treat. I was building up to this for a long time. I did a lot of research. Today on Open Loops, we have Andrew Dubashago, who is a time traveler and the most credible case of time travel agreed upon by many in this community of people who are looking for, I suppose you could say alternative beliefs or the paranormal realm, supernatural, all the things that I'm interested in. But Andrew, you've had quite a life. You've had a history. We're going to go into all of it. First of all, I just want to personally thank you for coming on the show.
You got it, Craig. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think that at the outset, I'd like to emphasize that the director of Project Pegasus, which was the U.S. time-space exploration program at the time of the advent of time travel in the U.S. defense technical community, was Dr. Harold M. Agnew. Now, just to preface our discussion today, it's important to recognize that Agnew was part of every aspect of Project Manhattan, the World War II project to build the atomic bomb, the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. He was in the squash courts at the University of Chicago when CP1, Critical Pile 1, was where they were experimenting with nuclear fission. He was manipulating one of the graphite rods to prevent an explosion when that nuclear pile, began going critical. As such, he was a prized physics graduate student of Dr. Enrico Fermi.
I was going to ask about Fermi, him. I was going to ask because I've read about the Chronovisor, and a lot of people talk about, well, I mean, we can get into what that exactly is, but for those who are listening that don't know, people say that there is in the Vatican a device where people can see the past and future events called the Chronovisor, and there's a lot of debate. A lot of people are like, it's a straight up hoax. They don't have this thing, but you've mentioned this name before in your lectures. Could you clarify exactly what that technology is, if it's because I know your Chronovisor is definitely different than that Chronovisor.
Well, actually they're related. The Chronovisor emerged when Fathers Pellegrino Arnetti and Agostino Gemelli, also known as Pier Maria Gemelli, that was his clerical name, were experimenting with Gregorian chants, and they were designing a device, like a microphone, to split the signals of the different voices in the Gregorian chants that they were studying, because they wanted to find out why Gregorian chants have sort of mystical properties, like healing properties.
Mm.
So they made a slight change on that device that was splitting the signals, and something that Father Gemelli's father had said to him in childhood, his nickname was My Little Zucchini in Italian. And so they heard his father's voice. So they realized, oh my God, we just found a way to access the past. That, and that was an accidental discovery. But because they were essentially musicologists and not physicists, they took their work to Dr. Enrico Fermi, the leading Italian physicist of that age, really of the world in the 40s and 50s. And this was, by the way, in the 1940s at the Catholic University of Milan, where this was going on. Now, I learned from my father, who was one of the principals on Project Pegasus, that the Vatican goes to other countries and their agencies to continue things that they've discovered. And one of those was the Chronovisor, which was basically a holographic form of time travel. Hmm. So it was given to the United States under the Navy, because, of course, the Navy, which originally had ambit overseeing over the space horizon, like what's on the other side of the ocean, was given ambit over the time horizon. So the Vatican gave the technology to the Navy for the Chronovisor, for this device that sees in time, a Chronovisor, right?
Mm.
And it was then turned into a standing hologram, not just a flat like TV screen, but a standing cubicle hologram at Bell Labs in Murray Hill, New Jersey, in the 50s. And my dad was part of that realm. I mean, he was working for different companies that were working on the leading advanced applications in quantum physics of that time. And as a result, he was brought into the project. But yes, the Chronovisor did exist. I took many trips in it.
Yeah.
For example, in the summer of 71, I was sent to Ford's Theater to see who shot President Lincoln about 8 times. And if you stood outside the Chronovisor, it was a looking glass, hence the term, the Project Looking Glass. But if the hologram was brought down around you, you spontaneously went to that past or future place. Most of it was past, and then I was in the experiment at ITT Defense Communications in Nutley, New Jersey, in fall of 1971, where we used Chronovision to go into the future. So the Chronovisor was a real device, and its origin was that famous story about the Vatican emergence of the Chronovisor. That's a true story. And I know it was a true story because not only was I told that story when I was on Project Pegasus in the late 60s and early 70s as one of the child chrononauts on the project, but Father Arnetti visited the Chronovisor in Morristown, New Jersey. And one of the technicians said to me, Andy, that priest in the back of the hall is Father Arnetti. I just wanted you to know that so you could appreciate what we're doing here.
Yeah.
Because I had heard about Father Arnetti and Gemelli's derivation of Chronovision on the speed learning program they were putting us through, which was called Galileo. And before we had contact with one of the time travel devices, we had like a learning program about its origin. So I knew who Father Anetti was, and he was being pointed out as a guest of honor at the DARPA's Chronovisor in Morristown, where I was born. So I can confirm the Vatican, the original discovery of Chronovision by Anetti and Gemelli of the Vatican.
Yeah. Do they still have any sort of, do you know if they have any time travel technology still in the Vatican?
Of course. Well, I don't. I'm not a Catholic cleric. I mean, I was raised as a Catholic, but I left the church at age 17. I'm now 59, which is about 42 years. I have no Vatican connections. I don't know, but presumably, yes. Presumably, yeah. DARPA and the U.S. government have chronovisors that they've been using ever since.
Yeah.
That would be my surmise, but again, I don't know that because I left Project Pegasus in 1972. Many, many years ago.
Yeah. I think what's amazing about your story is that we've had several phone calls before this interview. You've communicated to me that, hey, look, Greg, I'm a lawyer. I was working with people for years. I'm an academic. There is no reason for me to come forth with some bogus story that I'm making up because my entire career and reputation is on the line. I mean, I am kind of curious, Andy, do you remember the moment that you decided, hey, look, I'm going to go public with this? How did that happen?
Well, my father asked me to tell the family everything that happened. I have a large family, so he asked me that after he died, to convene a family meeting and tell them everything and then tell the entire world. This was in like November of 1989. And I said, Dad, why after all these years do you want me to talk about Project Pegasus? And he said, because we were in something great. And by that he meant that the derivation of time travel by the U.S. defense technical community was a great accomplishment of a great nation. He didn't want to see somebody else taking credit for it, which in fact is where we're at. So that was in 1989, but I completed my law degree and my certificate in environmental and natural resources law at Lewis and Clark, and then I earned two master's degrees. I earned a Master of City and Regional Planning with an environmental planning emphasis at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo with distinction, and then I studied for a year at Cambridge under Sir Malcolm John Grant, the British environmental affairs discipline, which is known as land economy. So I was doing something that I learned from the social psychologist Jean Maria Arrigo of California that bright people do with post-traumatic stress, which is they keep their minds very busy. Hmm. So, you know, it was 1989 when my dad asked me to tell the story, but it was a good 10 years before I sort of finished my career student pattern. And I thought, my God, you know, I started, for example, researching Harold Agnew because he had been the director of Project Pegasus. And I was just, as I was just previously saying, if I might just continue that line.
Yeah.
You know, he was at the squash courts at the University of Chicago. Then he was at Los Alamos when the bomb was designed and built. And then he was at Trinity Site in Alamogordo when it was tested. And then he flew from Los Alamos to the island of Tinian to take the nuclear trigger to put it aboard the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. And then he chased the plane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima in a chase plane known as the Great Artiste. The Great Artiste followed the Enola Gay as it was Colonel Paul Tibbetts was dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. And, you know, having that horrific result that we see in the brilliant work by Hiroshima, by John Hershey. And so I realized, well, wait a minute. If Agnew was part of every critical part of Project Manhattan, he must have been a very important person that my dad and I were reporting to because he was the first person we met the first time I teleported from the old Curtis Wright building in Woodridge, New Jersey, 1 Passaic Avenue, Woodridge, New Jersey, to the Santa Fe State Capitol grounds, where we then got a state vehicle and drove over to Los Alamos and met with Dr. Agnew.
How old were you when you teleported? How old were you?
Six was my first time teleporting across the country.
Wow.
And my dad was kind of laughing because, you know, his hair was dancing all over the tunnel that we entered in because of electrostatic discharge. And he said, I looked terrified. I was just pretty much overwhelmed from the experience of going through a vortal tunnel in time space. I mean, I was only 6 years old.
Yeah.
And they were doing that because they were trying to acclimate children to time travel for a variety of reasons. So that was sort of part of the program. My dad was sort of bringing me into it easy. But he was also, I think, using me to show Dr. Agnew that, look, if teleportation was safe enough for his youngest son, his number three son, as he identified me to Dr. Agnew, when we met with him there in winter of 1968, when I first teleported to New Mexico, that it was safe enough for anybody's child. And I'm still working on what my dad believed we should do with teleportation, which is basically achieve global public teleportation. And that's really what I decided to do, to emphasize when I decided to come forward around the year 2000 or so, finally fulfilling my dad's request to me. He died in a few months after he made that request. He died in January of 90. But it wasn't really until 98, 99, when I began investigating my experiences in earnest, he had said to me in that 1989 discussion, it's going to take you a while to tie all the pieces together, but you do. Because see, they of course had quantum access, and they were in possession of the book that I just finished in 2019, Around the Poolside, in 1971. It was shown to me by my dad's friend, who was also on the project, a woman named Connie Chavez, in Albuquerque. They literally had my future book, just like they had a book I would edit, Exopolitics by Alfred Lumbermont Weber. So I was constantly dealing with my father, yes, but I was dealing with a CIA officer who was in possession of quantum access, knowledge about future events.
Oh, I never, so, that's interesting. Yeah. Your book, you had your future book in the 70s.
Yes, my book is entitled Once Upon a Time in the Time Stream. And Connie Chavez would let me read the left pages, which said Once Upon a Time, but not the right pages that had as a header In the Time Stream, because that was original. So that's the standing orders they were under. Never reveal something about the future to somebody that may cause them to balk and not do it. So like when my father told me that I was going to be attending Cambridge in the future, he said, so if you're invited to Cambridge, go. You see? They were always trying to avoid somebody balking as a result of being told what the future held.
Yeah. Did they ever talk to you about any of the classical paradoxes of messing with future events or knowing about your future? I would feel like it's a philosophical conundrum to have future stuff in the past. Like, could that book, the contents, have changed based on actions even holding a book you had written in the future?
Yeah, they were explaining to us with lectures by people like Jack Pruitt, my father, Dr. Agnew, and others. And they were also on that speed learning machines on the tachistoscopes that the Office of Naval Research had developed, which was basically a form of speed learning where we were attending those lectures in that specialized learning program called Galileo.
Yeah, I've never heard you talk about that before. What is Galileo? Yeah. I'm fascinated by that.
It was basically a history of science and society from the year 1450 with different learning modules mixed in about the time travel devices we were going to have exposure to and what their derivation had been. So they explained to us that if you go back in time to try to become yourself and change the past, you can't. You can visit yourself. So like if I use the example of Ted Kennedy trying to prevent the Chappaquiddick accident. Mm. If Ted Kennedy had gone back in time to prevent Chappaquiddick, he couldn't have been Ted Kennedy behind the wheel of that automobile that accidentally drove off that bridge, resulting in the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, unfortunately. But he could visit himself. Now, when they explained how, not using the Ted Kennedy example, that's my example, but they explained how when you do go back to try to visit yourself, you can visit yourself, but you can't become yourself. That's why I've always said, and it's a truism, you cannot go back and change the past by becoming the original person that you were in the past. You can only go back and fulfill the past. You see?
Mm.
So when Ted Kennedy would leave for the past to visit himself to try to prevent Chappaquiddick, he would at most remember seeing himself on the Chappaquiddick Bridge as an older version of himself, waving to himself, "Hey, Ted, Ted, don't drive through this bridge. You know, don't drive across this bridge."
Yeah.
Now, when you try to, when you rely on information from the future that's been taken back to the present, you can help create the future. So if, for example, let's say David Axelrod was given future information that Barack Obama was going to be elected president and therefore decided to join his campaign and help him get elected, then the future information that was saved with David Axelrod would have helped create the very future he'd been told of. You see?
Yeah.
That's how quantum access operates.
Interesting. You know what's interesting also is the speed learning. It sounds like I personally have been fascinated with accelerated learning and using mind technology to actually teach kids to deeply embed ideas as opposed to the superficial educational system that I was brought through. I mean, do they have some special technology that we don't have access to today?
Well, we don't have access to it because I know my school district, which was the Hanover Township School District in New Jersey, they threw those away. I spoke to Harvey Altman, who had been my itinerant music instructor back in elementary school, who taught me how to play the saxophone, and he had become the principal of Memorial Middle School in Whippany, New Jersey. And he told me that those tachistoscopes, those speed learning machines, had been thrown away like a year earlier. This was around the year 2000. So those devices were so effective that I went on to get 11 years of post-secondary education, and David, one of my colleagues, went on to get 12 years. He became an MD, PhD. I became a JD, MCRP, DIST, MPhil, CANTAB. So in other words, the kids who were put on those tachistoscopes became really distinguished academics, the most distinguished academics of our generation. But the device was so effective that when I was in the college quiz bowl at UCLA during my undergraduate years, sometime during the early 80s, it was from 1980 to 84 that I was at UCLA. I don't remember exactly what year I participated in the college quiz bowl. But the question was asked centuries before Copernicus developed his heliocentric theory of the universe, this Greek philosopher did. Now, that was the whole question. But before I chimed in, all that had been asked was centuries before for Nicholas Copernicus.
Yeah.
And I pressed the button and said, I thought I was acting like I was on Jeopardy because I had tried out for Jeopardy in Hollywood and didn't get on it. So I said, even though I was participating in the college quiz bowl, I said, who is Aristarchus of Samos? And the question asker of the competition said, Mr. Rashago, let me complete the question. And then he just completed the full question. So I had so many facts from the past in my unconscious from those tachistoscopes that I was literally able to answer the question centuries before and then chime in with Aristarchus of Samos. And then the question asker, which actually was the prominent lawyer, Bennett Vandebunt, who went on to be the general counsel and then the president of Guthrie Ranker. He did a lot of work with Tony Robbins and different products promoted by Guthrie Ranker. So Ben then said, well, Mr. Bashago, let me complete the question. Centuries before Nicholas Copernicus framed his heliocentric theory of the universe, that the planets revolve around the sun, this Greek philosopher did. And so that's how primed I was as a result of having all those you know, facts buried in my unconscious by that device.
How does that device work? What was a tachistoscope exactly?
It was basically like almost like encyclopedia entries, like text and photographs and drawings that would be put up on a screen for about a second, and we had been taught to speed read, and we would just stand there at the machine, and it would do like one screen a second, and reading them. Yeah, imagine reading a page of the Encyclopedia Britannica every second. That's the speed learning that they had inculcated in our young minds.
Wow. Forget time travel for a second and all this other stuff. That to me feels like if we wanted to beat, you know, they always talk about China and wanting to have the better educational system and all that stuff. Why? I guess the big question I have that's going to kind of tie all this together is, in general, why would they get rid of this technology? From a learning perspective, why develop something like this, do you think, and then get rid of all these machines?
Well, I think things advance, and in a free society, they're abandoned for different reasons. I mean, the school districts got rid of them. The Department of Education fell into political correctness rather than Cold War readiness, as it were.
Yeah. I know most people don't have access to time travel, but do you think, like, could you talk to people who grew up in New Jersey around that area that would remember these devices?
Undoubtedly, yes. I mean, I spoke to some of the participants, and they remembered the learning machines. They remembered the Montauk chair that we were using to visit moments in our own subjective futures.
Yeah.
They remembered me. One of them remembered teleporting to New Mexico. And he, in fact, was the boy who lost his feet teleporting to New Mexico.
Oh, what is that story?
Well, he arrived in a fountain or a catch basin of some kind that had about 3 inches of water in it. And so the specific gravity of the water was such that his feet and everything above, like the middle of his ankles, arrived at different times. And as a result, they were severed, and he toppled out of the water basin with his sneakers and feet still in the basin. And I ran up to his location. He was screaming, my feet, I'm only 9 years old. What am I going to do without any feet? Well, when I first called that individual in 2005, 2006, I certainly remembered him. He was in my kindergarten and first grade, and then he was held back. He lived down the street from me. His name was Kevin. I don't want to give his last name.
Right.
And Kevin remembered teleporting to New Mexico. But then when I realized that Kevin was the boy who lost his feet, both he and his two brothers refused to get on the phone with me, presumably because they had been paid. I don't know.
Wow.
But Kevin, if you're listening, please contact me. You can find my number through the Washington State Bar Association website at WSBA.org. Just give me a call.
Wow.
We've got to talk. I could potentially get you a lot more money for your grievous injuries in your heroic service on behalf of our great country. So please call me, Kevin.
Yeah. Wow. Okay, so wait. So back to Harold Agnew. So you are 6 years old, or you said nine.
Right.
You said six.
No, I was six.
Yeah. So you're six. You step into, does your dad tell you you're about to step into a vortex and come out the other side? What do you remember from that day, if anything?
Well, in Building 68 at Curtis Wright, there were the two elliptical booms of the teleporter, the so-called Tesla energetic array. And the fact that it was a teleporter had been accidentally discovered there at Curtis Wright after Tesla's death. He just had it listed energetic array in his papers. So they set it up and turned it on. And one of the technicians walked through the radiant energy flowing between the two armatures of the device, these two elliptical shaped booms, as we sometimes call them. And he tumbled forward through time space and arrived in Africa. And the African tribesmen and women who encountered him thought he was a god. And this caused, somebody wrote the story that was Maitreya. That individual who's now in prison, lost his vision in prison, I'll have to remember his name, Sean David Morton. Sean David Morton said it was Maitreya who first teleported, and he teleported to Africa. It wasn't. That was just a folkloric story. It was... It was just an ordinary technician, but he did arrive in Africa, and it took him either 6 weeks or 6 months to get home. And when he walked back into that room where the teleporter was located in Building 68 there at Curtis Wright Aeronautical Company in Woodridge, New Jersey, his supervisor collapsed because he thought, of course, he'd been disintegrated by the device. He didn't realize he'd been sent somewhere. So my dad just took me up there and explained that we were going to jump through the device, that we had to do so very quickly, at 1 meter per second, to not be injured by the device. That's what he said, injured, but actually that meant dismembered by the device. And we did a couple practice runs, and they said, okay, son, at the count of three, and we at the count of three, he held my hand and we ran through the device and we tumbled through this vortal tunnel in the fabric of time space and then popped out in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a distance of 2,005 miles. And in that act, I became the first American child to teleport. Wow. And that was the first of a number of firsts that I was able to compile in the program. And that's really another reason I continue to speak out, because look, and that's why I always bring up Harold Agnew. You know, my dad was one of those Defense Department engineers who has kind of been lost to history because he really didn't seek the limelight.
Yeah.
But Harold Agnew is a principal physicist of applied quantum physics in the 20th century. Just like J.B. Johnson worked with my dad at the Edison Labs, you know, the discoverer of white noise. Harold Agnew is a named principal in the history of physics. And I spoke with him as early as 2000. And he helped me with my investigation.
Huh.
So the guy was a great man, a great American. I mean, I remember he always used to push his index finger into my belly button when I'd walk past him when we were on the project. But that is indeed the director of Project Pegasus. It wasn't just some, you know, it wasn't somebody as is frequently said, like Einstein or John von Neumann or whatever in all these cover stories.
Yeah.
It was Harold M. Agnew. Agnew was responsible for the U.S. time travel program.
Wow. Yeah. I know. I've Google searched Harold Agnew and time travel, and of course nothing comes up. I mean, it's like an insane thing to like Google for somebody to disclose publicly if it is true.
Well, they always give the cover stories. They always mention Hiroshima or his work at LANL, but they don't reveal that as the man on Project Manhattan, who was trusted to take the nuclear trigger from Los Alamos to Tinian Island to be put aboard the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, or Hiroshima, as it's also pronounced, you're not going to be telling that. I mean, go to Alexa. It doesn't say that Harold Agnew was the director of the U.S. Time Space Program, but that's in fact what he was. That's why my information is so heretical to the establishment, because they have convinced university historians basically to lie for them.
Yeah.
None of them have called me. I mean, I studied history at UCLA under its many great history professors. None of them have contacted me. I mean, I was in touch with Dr. Roger Daniel McGrath, a great historian of the West, just to get his sense of how I should tell the story in light of the heretical nature of it. But no, we have, you know, we all have Alexa now, and Alexa's lying to us.
Yeah.
So we're losing our history. We're losing our understanding of what our society has accomplished. That's another major reason why, as a history graduate of UCLA, I'm speaking out. I don't want to see this great country fall behind in even taking credit for what it's developed. And one of its developments was teleportation, chronovision, the plasma confinement chamber, and so forth. That literally time travel technology, or triple T as it was known.
Huh. Do you think it's a case of, and this is where, you know, I think the skeptical minded people come in, time travel technology, but then everybody that claims that, you know, whether it's time travel, whether it's Area 51 and aliens, that, well, of course, you know, the papers were burned and everything's burned, and it always seems, quote unquote, convenient excuse. Do you think there are papers out there, though, still? Is there any paperwork, any trail of physical evidence that actually has proof that this happened in existence that's just buried somewhere?
It's not buried. I've presented it. I spent years talking about how when they took my picture at Gettysburg on November 19th of 1863, where I'm in the front left foreground of the so-called Josephine Cobb image of Lincoln at Gettysburg, that I was fading from view right as the photograph was being taken. And then the photo analyst, John Gannon and William B. Stillings, found that the picture shows my cheekbone and my eye socket. Now, there were known Civil War photo defects. Yeah. Like when somebody walked when the picture was being taken, we see kind of that blurring. But seeing into the viscera of a person, seeing into the substructure of their body, beyond their skin, as it were, was not such a known Civil War defect. So I've literally had that information public for about 10 years. I also had lectured on radio and publicly about the fact that when I asked my dad, how are they designing, you know, how are they creating these holograms that are sending me to the past? This was when I was still just being sent to the past by a chronovision. And he said, we're putting an EM signal, an electromagnetic signal, through 8-sided bismuth crystals. And then a researcher in England, a number of years ago, about 5 years ago, a researcher in England named Wynne Keach found a 1967 patent involving 8-sided bismuth crystals that had been granted the physicist Leo Osaki, which mentions my dad's work with bismuth crystals in the first listing of the prior arts section of that patent. Now, if you think I'm making up some tall tale or some, tall drink of water, as it were,
right?
How could I plant a photo from 1863 that shows my cheek and eye socket? And how could I plant a patent that somebody was granted in 1967 that references a 1962 patent that my father and his colleague Neil T. Williams were given by the patent office?
Yeah, I've seen that photo.
I was born in 1961. How could I plant a patent a year after I was born? You see, so these are ineluctable proofs. These are unstoppable, unbeatable proofs. So in answer to your question, it's not just a matter of evidence existing somewhere. I've brought it forward.
Yeah.
But many people haven't listened. They haven't contextualized what I've been saying and doing. And it's frustrating, but I will persevere.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think do you believe beyond those real two? I mean, and I've seen the photo. I mean, it does raise a lot of questions. Like, it seems it's publicly available. People could check it out. A view at Gettysburg. It's a remarkable image.
Yeah. And by the way, it's one of only 5% of such images that were saved from the Civil War era, because after the war, the four by five slides that they were printed on were used in greenhouses, and they all faded in the sun. So the fact that the Josephine Cobb image still exists to show me is a 5% possibility. It's a 5% piece of good luck. It should have been destroyed, but it was not.
Yeah. How did you come across that? How did you come across that image?
It was published in a news magazine, and I was on the front stoop of our home in Morris Plains, New Jersey, in 1972, the summer of 1972, after I'd been sent there to Gettysburg in the spring of 1972, and I found that image. Now, I think it was Life magazine, but it may have been, for all I know, some other magazine, but it was 1972, and it was showing how the Josephine Cobb image had been discovered in the early 50s. And I showed it to one of my sisters, and I said, look, that's me. They got a picture of me when they sent me to Gettysburg. And this particular sister looked at the image in the magazine and said, that's not you. That's just some boy from that time. Then I took it inside. My dad was reading the Sunday paper at his reading desk, his reading chair. And I said, look, Dad, when you all sent me to Gettysburg, they got a picture of me. And he looked at it, and he said, yep, just don't tell anybody. Well, here I am all these years, because he didn't know that, you know, 18 years later, he would ask me to tell the story of that and everything connected to Project Pegasus.
Huh.
But that's me in the picture. I will go to my death in this life. Of course, my soul will never die. But I will go to my physical death in this life stating that, because it is the truth. And, you know, I was steeped in Washingtonia as somebody born in Morristown and growing up in Morris Plains. Morristown, of course, was where George Washington had wintered in the winters of 1777 and 81. And I shall not tell a lie. That's all I've done, is not tell a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, at one point
I have never lied.
I asked you about why the government hasn't taken you out, and you told me it's because you're speaking the absolute truth.
No, there were actually a couple of reasons. When I first started researching, talking about and writing about my experiences, I was warned by a representative of the executive office of the president, President George W. Bush, in 2003, that if I didn't stop investigating, talking, or writing about my time travel experiences, that because the technologies involved remained sensitive, compartmentalized national security secrets. If I continued to do so, they couldn't, quote, guarantee my survival. Now, that's when Donald Rumsfeld was still defense secretary, and he was the defense attaché on the time travel program, Project Pegasus. But then later, a CIA operative named, a CIA agent named Virginia Olds, told me that because I was speaking so consistently with the truth, with the facts, not embellishing, not valorizing my own participation, not engaging in sort of the post-Vietnam syndrome of always trying to depict the U.S. government as evil, the CIA as nothing but a corrupt, you know, oligarchy that we should get rid of.
Yeah.
That they were happy with how I was presenting the information, and that the CIA as a collective had essentially agreed to let me go forward.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because you know what? The conspiracy people out there are always saying that the CIA is connected to, you know, some higher elite organization, military industrial complex, and you speak ill of them or their operations, they're going to take you out. In general, what's been interesting about your account is that it doesn't really, you're not really demonizing any of the government.
No, I didn't have a desire to, because my father and I had worked for the government. Now, he was CIA. I never was. I was just a kid on that project that they then sent to Mars, that then worked on an NSA project that I don't like to talk about. So it was basically somebody essentially used as an operative by the intel community, but I was never a decision maker or a CIA agent or officer. There's a difference. Operatives, for example, are never paid. Operators are. That's a great misconception. So after I brought all this information forward as a critic of the CIA and the rest of the intel community, and believe me, I had a beef with the intel community because I hadn't been paid. I had participated in three classified defense-related research and development programs in which I could have died, and I almost did a couple times. And they didn't pay me. They didn't benefit me. I'm still working on getting paid by the government, and I don't want to discuss that, but I'm moving forward on that effort. The government knows who I am. But what actually happened initially was I did so many radio interviews. I went on a tear where I did like 100 interviews in a year and a half, or maybe just a year. And that was to protect my life. I call that the reverse Danny Casolaro approach. Look, if you've got secret, dangerous information, tell it. Don't hold it.
Yeah.
Because you will, by telling it, you will remove the motive to kill you. I believe Danny Casolaro was murdered because he had secret information about the octopus that he wasn't writing up. Okay, so I did what I call the reverse Danny Casolaro principle. I talked my head off. I did conferences all over the hemisphere. I did 500 radio shows in 15 countries beyond our borders. And I basically was protecting myself by speaking out. So they know who I am, and they know I've been telling the truth, but a lot of intel people have called me. I mean, the ones who have called me have been very grateful and respectful because I have not been a critic of the government. Instead, I've been describing what this great country has achieved.
Well, let's pause here. Part one of podcast Pegasus. Already a mind blower, right? I did not expect to go into Project Galileo with that. Some of you know I'm a big fan of accelerated learning and the possibilities of mind potential, so it was so cool to go into that. And what a nice note to end on. This is premiering Memorial Day 2021, and look, I just want to thank everybody out there that's given their service to this country. I think, time travel or not, we've accomplished a lot. And it's awesome that Andy is, he's such a patriot. Tomorrow we're going to delve more into the different forms of time travel, the 8 types Andy experienced, the hazards of time travel, and some stuff you definitely won't want to miss. Talk soon.